Okay, tonight is going to be quite the foot race. We hope, without any possibility of failure, we'll cover three chapters tonight, 46, 47, and 48. And in order to make sure, or hoping at least, that it will contribute to it, I am not going to have any more slides than the one you see before you and which we've already seen twice before. We are concluding tonight this section, chapters 40 through 48, which is one of my personal very favorite sections. It is a triumphant declaration from God himself that he is God and he is God alone. This is primarily demonstrated throughout chapters 40 through 48 in these nine chapters by means of prophecy, which is over and over and over again. It's been several weeks ago now, but we spent a whole class just reading nothing but God foretelling the future or speaking of times when he has foretold the future. That ability sets him apart from every other religious group to this day that has ever claimed, you know, the allegiance and attention of human beings. Yahweh is God. He is the only God. His religion is the only religion, and his way is the only way to heaven. And he demonstrates that through these numerous and most specific prophecies. So not only do we spend a whole night looking at those prophecies, but then we've come back and we've been going line by line through each one of these chapters and seeing that there are three other topics that arise in the course of this section. Babylon will be mentioned for the last time in the whole book of Isaiah tonight. But there are prophecies about Babylon, where Isaiah has been predicting the future, that figure highly. So that's one of the examples of God's predictive ability. Idolatry has also been laced through the whole thing, because what God is doing is contending with the idolaters and those people that have trusted in them. And so, you know, again and again and again and again, we've seen idolatry passages as well. And then, almost like a bit of a prelude to the last chapters, 49 through 66, that largest section of the book, 49 through 66, is going to be about Jesus the Christ and a whole galaxy of things surrounding him in the course of those chapters. They are really the climax and the epitome of the reasons why Isaiah is called the Prince of the Prophets. There will be just soaring declarations throughout these chapters, 49 through 66, about Jesus the Christ. But he has been woven in already in 40 through 48 as well. So that's the only thing we're going to look at tonight. As far as slides go, it's the same slide we've been looking at. And tonight we're going to cover 46, 47, and 48 and bring this magnificent section then to a close, which begins in chapter 46 and will continue in chapter 47. So you can put a title on both of those that they are about and addressed to Babylon. So here's the lengthiest section in these chapters that will be dealing with Babylon. It's already arisen to some extent, this country, but now is the focus for two chapters. Now, it begins with, Bel has bowed down, Nebo stoops over. Their images are consigned to the beasts and the cattle. The things that you carry are burdensome, the load for the weary beast. They stooped over, they bowed down together, they could not rescue the burden, they have themselves gone into captivity. So simultaneously, we've also got the idolatry thing going on here. But you might want to make a sort of a footnote of some kind, if you can, or marginal reference there. Bel and Nebo are two of the Babylonian gods. And particularly, Nebo is the one that, though not exclusively, you will find being named in the names of the Babylonian kings, the most famous of which would be Nebuchadnezzar, which we say Nebuchadnezzar, but in their language, the first thing, you know, that you hear in his name is Nebo. Then we have Bel, named for me, a Babylonian king that begins with Bel. Belshazzar, Belteshazzar is another one. And so with regard to Nebo, you've got Nabonidus. There are several of these names, and so from henceforth, probably knew it already, every time you see those names, just remember the first part of it is a tribute to an idolatrous god. Pardon me whilst I cough. I've been doing really well, you know, on the reflux thing, but I had a bad one here Sunday night or Monday, I forget which, and I'm paying for it now. So, throat's kind of raw. At any rate, Bel has bowed down and Nebo has stooped over, is to say those gods are nothing and they must pay tribute and show their obeisance and allegiance, if only they could, you know, to the God of heaven, Yahweh. And we'll have this developed, you know, even further here. And in those sections that are dealing with that idolatry, we'll go rather quickly now because we've seen it several times. So this is just the grand conclusion on that contest with the Babylonian gods or with idolatry in general. Bill?
Didn't the guys have a god that was named Bel?
A god that was what?
A god that was named Bel.
Yes, Bel and Nebo both. There was actually a third god, Marduk. And so in scriptures, when you see any one of those three, you know, those are primarily associated with Babylon. I'm not sure about this, but it seems to me Marduk might even be kind of their chief god. But for royalty's sake, you know, they're going with Bel and Nebo and the Nemi. Okay, so verse 3. Now, listen to me, O house of Jacob, and all the remnant of the house of Israel. What's happened to Israel? They've long ago been taken into captivity and destroyed by Assyria, so there's only a remnant, just a scattered few that somehow managed to escape all that. Listen to me, O house of Jacob, and all the remnant of the house of Israel, you who have been born by me from birth and have been carried from the womb. Even your old age, I shall be the same, and even your graying years, I shall bear you. I've done it, and I shall carry you, and I shall bear you, and I shall deliver you. Now, remember, we had a burden in verses 1 and 2. The cattle were wearied by the burden. What is the burden that the cattle are carrying around? Bel and Nebo and Marduk. Because they can't walk, they can't talk, they can't do anything. So, you know, you guys are just burdens for beasts, those gods. But in contrast to that, you see this bearing and carrying and delivering that God is doing for his people. So those gods are burdens to be borne by cattle. The God is the burden bearer who carries all of his people. And so in 5, to whom would you liken me and make me equal and compare me that we should be alike? Those who lavish gold from the purse and weigh silver on the scale hire a goldsmith and he makes it into a god. They bow down, indeed they worship it. They lift it up upon the shoulder and carry it. They set it in its place and it stands. It does not move from its place. Though one may cry to it, it cannot answer. It cannot deliver him from his distress. Now, we've seen that several times before in those very ideas before in this section, 40 through 48. So I'm not going to comment on 5 through 7. It is a repeat of that concept. Now, starting in verse 8 through 11, do any of you just raise your hand if you have some sort of a note or reference to these verses in your margin? Okay. From the class 3 or 4 weeks ago, this is one of those God alone can foretell the future passages that we looked at. So we've already read this a couple of weeks ago, but again we'll do it tonight in 8 through 11. Remember this and be assured. Recall it to mind, you transgressors. Remember the former things long past. For I am God, and there is no other. I am God, and there is no one like me. Declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times, things which have not been done, saying, my purpose will be established, and I will accomplish all my good pleasure, calling a bird of prey from the east, the man of my purpose from a far country, Truly I have spoken. Truly I will bring it to pass. I have planned it. I will do it. Who is the bird of prey from the east? That is Cyrus. So write it in the margin. That is Cyrus for sure. Then we first heard about him back in the... I'm trying to find it right now and it's escaping me. Where did he first pop up? It's chapter 41. And in chapter 41 of verse 2, who has aroused one from the east, whom he calls in righteousness to his feet? It's the same expression, calling this one from the east. That one is Cyrus. How do you know it's Cyrus? Tell me. Well, true enough, but there's something even more specific than that.
He named him.
Where did he name him? See, again, I'm hoping you got some markings. You can go back, and this is it. You're thinking, oh, I remember somewhere in Isaiah that Cyrus is named. So where is it? Well, for me, of course, I've highlighted it, and I'm hoping you will too. So I'm going to point it out again. He is named in chapter 44 at verse 28. He is again named in chapter 45 and in verse 1. Cyrus is named 150 years before he's born and has become a theme in the course of chapters 40 through 48. He is a central, I think the most prominent, demonstration of God's ability to tell the end from the beginning, to foretell the future. And so, magnificently so, if you can name somebody who's not even born yet and then describe what they're going to do, this man is the bird of prey that's coming from the east. Now, he's going to come up one more time in the course of our studies here tonight, and then that'll be the last time that Cyrus is going to appear in the book. So, in 46, and in verses 8 through 11, make some kind of note, in addition, not only to God alone can foretell the future, but, you know, put Cyrus next to that. This is the one and only man where possibly we can identify him and nobody else. There just isn't possible that we can make a mistake on this. This is the Cyrus who's already been named. And then if you like, here at a passage like this, you could write in the margin Isaiah 44:28 and Isaiah 45:1, where the actual name itself is there to prove it, the man from the east. 12, listen to me, you stubborn-minded who are far from righteousness. I bring near my righteousness. It is not far off, and my salvation will not delay, and I will grant salvation in Zion and my glory for Israel. So the people that he's talking to in verse 12, I don't think is Israel. Though they are referred to as stubborn in quite a few passages in the Old Testament, in this case, I think really it's still Babylon. Babylon is what's in view. Bel and Nebo are stooping down. They're carried around by cattle because they can't do anything else. I can foretell the future, Yahweh says. I already have. I'm going to do it some more. And so listen to me, you Babylonians in verse 12, you stubborn-minded who are far from righteousness. I bring near my righteousness. It is not far off. My salvation will not delay. I'll grant salvation in Zion. My glory for Israel makes you think it might be talking to or even about the Israelites, but it's really not. It's a proof or regards Babylon and stating before it takes place that Israel is going to be righteous, his righteousness will be brought to them. The salvation will not delay. The salvation for Zion and glory for Israel is now referencing when they'll be released from the Babylonian captivity at the end of the 70 years. Now, 46 chapters, very short there, but it also does not conclude the thought. So in 47:1, we're still talking about those Babylonians. I don't think it was a separate prophecy at all. I think all of this, was one prophecy, but we get a chapter heading, helps us to reference things. But see, it goes straight on, come down and sit in the dust, O virgin daughter of what? Babylon. Sit on the ground without a throne, O daughter of the Chaldeans. There's no difference between the two. They're just two different names for the Babylonians, these Chaldeans. For you shall no longer be called tender and delicate. Now, these next verses, all the way down through verse 7, really and following, are now portraying Babylon as a virgin daughter who has known luxury and all the best that life can offer, as well as speaking of mothers who have always enjoyed the peace and security of a powerful nation, and now they are going to be addressed. So it's the virgin daughter of Babylon, well, that's Babylon itself, but sit on the ground without a throne, O daughter of the Chaldeans, that's Babylon itself, but now see how it's pictured, verse 2. Take the millstones and grind meal. Who does that? Slaves would do that, or if you're not a slave, who would do that? Well, that's right, but sticking to the people. Yes, yes, yes. But not unless... I mean, you're all right. It's the women, it's the mothers, it's the children, you know, the girl children. It's the women's responsibility. But who are the ones that do it? The wealthy women in Babylon, do they do it? No. You all said servants, servants. That's right. And if you're grinding and you're not a slave, then what are you? Conquered people would still be a slave. You're still impoverished. You got to do it yourself. Okay, so what he's saying is, you who have never grinded ground, you've never been grinders, take that one. Okay, but you've never done this kind of thing, you will. And so it's a picture of Babylon itself being reduced to this, but it's calling up these images that everybody knows. Wealthy people don't do their own grinding. Free people who are wealthy enough don't do their own grinding. But if you're a slave, you're doing the grinding for somebody else, or else, even if you're free, you're too poor to hire anybody else to do it. So it's an image of abject, you know, loss and poverty and deprivation. Remove your veil. Strip off the skirt. Uncover the leg. Cross the rivers. Your nakedness will be uncovered. Your shame also will be exposed. I will take vengeance and will not spare a man. Literally, it says, will not meet a man. So when I'm done with you, none of you, now portrayed Babylon as a woman, could even find a man. I'm killing all of them off. But any of you women would feel exactly the same way if this was a description of you. At the end of verse 1, you will no longer be called tender and delicate. Take the millstones, grind meal. And then once again, you're stripped of all the clothing that you would be proud of or that would give you comfort in bad weather or whatever. Remove your veil, strip off the skirt, then uncover the leg and cross the rivers. Now the picture I think here is that those two go together. If you don't have a boat, you don't have a ferry, you don't have, you know, that chase that they carry around with the slaves to lift you up over the water when you come to a river, then what are you going to do before you walk through a river? You're going to pull your skirt up, hike your skirt up, because you're going to have to walk through the water. This is not what the tender and the delicate and the wealthy and the powerful and the influential do. This is not what a Babylonian thinks they should ever do. And so it's just this most embarrassing picture for the women's sake of how they're losing everything that they had any confidence or love for that would bring them dignity and honor and respect, you know, and people look up to you. You're just running for your life and dashing through the rivers and, you know, grinding your own meal. Nakedness in verse 3, uncovered, shame exposed, and there won't be a man to be found. 4. our Redeemer, Yahweh of hosts is His name, the Holy One of Israel. Sit silently. Go into darkness, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for you will no more be called the Queen of Kingdoms. I was angry with my people. I profaned my heritage and gave them into your hand. You did not show mercy to them. On the aged you made your yoke very heavy, yet you said, I shall be queen forever. These things you did not consider nor remember the outcome of them. Now, brethren, this is one of those passages, noticing the verb tense, that causes people to say it must have been written after the fact. Now, don't let this bother you at all, because there are passages where God declares that He speaks of future things as if what? As if they're already done. And if He says a thing is going to come to pass, then it will. So you can speak of it in the past tense. It is so certain that that's going to be the case. And this is what God is doing here. It clearly is a foretelling of the future. But He is choosing to use this particular manner of speaking to illustrate, to demonstrate the certainty of what He's going to come to pass, or going to bring to pass. And so, you know, of course, those who are less open, whose hearts are hardened, whose minds are closed, and, you know, they don't want to serve God, they're looking for every excuse they can, pounce on this kind of terminology. See, you guys are claiming it's foretelling the future, but the writer messed up, and he used the past tense, and so the cover's blown. You can all see, you know, it's just a guy talking about something that already happened. Well, not so. The whole point of all of this is that Yahweh is God because He can foretell the future. So now, continuing in verse 8, what we have in verse 4, in the middle of it, is then what would have been, I think, if you were hearing Isaiah present this verbally, would be, I think they should have put a blank line both before and then after verse 4. There would have been like a chorus, a demonstration, just to shout God's name. Our Redeemer, Yahweh of hosts is His name, the Holy One of Israel. And then you go back to what you're doing. It's just a refrain where you burst out, you know, to give praise, and then go back to sit silently in darkness, O daughter of the Chaldeans. You know, you've had it. Now in 8 it continues, now then hear this, you sensual one who dwells securely, who says in your heart, I am, and there's no one besides me. Brother, I could hardly think of a more blasphemous and arrogant thing to say. Could you? What does Yahweh mean? I was, I am, and I will be. And what's been the whole point of all these prophecies? There is none besides me. Now you say, I am, and there's no one beside me? I shall not sit as a widow, nor shall I know lots of children. Well, anybody in Babylon that would say that, that's thinking that, is speaking of not being a widow or knowing the loss of children, is a reference to what? It's not stillbirth. It's not sudden infant death. What is it? It's not pneumonia. Why would you become a widow? Why would you lose children?
War.
They're the superpower. I'll never know an invasion. I'll never know, you know, any invaders. I'll never have my sons die in war. We'll always win. We'll just sweep over everybody. You know, I'm never going to lose any children because none of my children would ever be at any kind of risk. I'm that secure. Well, verse 9, but these two things shall come on you suddenly in one day. Loss of children and widowhood. They shall come on you in full measure, in spite of your many sorceries, in spite of the great power of your spells. And you felt secure in your wickedness and said, no one sees me. Your wisdom and your knowledge, they have deluded you. For you said in your heart, I am, and there's no one besides me. We can see, brethren, it just rankles God. It just so annoys him that anyone dare would say those kinds of things. And so I rather think they were saying these things. We are the Babylonians. Now, as a matter of fact, you know Daniel's book right well. What was Nebuchadnezzar himself going to do that would bring him low?
He put
himself
above God.
Yeah. Marching around on his walls and looking out over his magnificent city and kingdom, and then look what I did. I am the king of Babylon. And so what's he doing the next day? Yeah, he's eating grass. This is just so infuriating for God. So twice, you say, I am. Well, he'll just see that there'll be an end to that, and you won't be anymore. You're out of here. And there's no one besides you. In a night, it'll happen. And of course, we know historically that's exactly what happened. Medes and Persians invaded. They succeeded in undermining via the river, one of the walls that Babylon was built on. And as Daniel had prophesied, her handwriting was on the wall, and they're done in a day. Now, in verse 11, but evil will come on you, which you will not know how to charm away. A disaster will fall on you, for which you cannot atone, and destruction, about which you do not know, will come on you suddenly. Stand fast now in your spells and in your many sorceries, with which you have labored from your youth. Perhaps you'll be able to profit. Perhaps you may cause trembling. Who does that sound like on Mount Carmel? The prophets of Baal and their utter failure, you know, and God's prophet, who is that? Elijah, mocking them the whole time. They're cutting themselves to show their devotion to their God. And he says, cry out louder. Maybe your God is sleeping or on a vacation. Okay. And so here's the same thing that God is doing. He says, okay, stand in your spells, your sorceries, you labored in them from your youth. Perhaps you'll be able to profit. Perhaps you may cause trembling. You know, good luck with that. 13, you are wearied with your many counsels. Let now the astrologers, those who prophesy by the stars, those who predict by the new moons, stand up and save you from what will come upon you. Now, this is another, you know, very brief, but it is God alone predicting the future. You know, he can do it. They can't. So he challenges them to do it. But make a note, if you will, at verse 13. Who invented astrology? The Babylonians. Okay, so just make a note. God's crying out against, you know, their astrology. They're the guys that invented the whole idea to study the stars and, you know, and making predictions and all that. What, you know, what sign are you and all that garbage is something that's been going on for a long time. But it's the Babylonians that invented it. So now God is saying, okay, make your prediction. You know, stare up at the sky and tell me what's going to happen. Tell you what's going to happen. They can't save you. None of your idols and none of your astrologers, none of your sorcerers, none of your mediums. There's just nobody going to help you out. Here's what will happen to them in 14. Behold, they've become like stubble. Fire burns them. They cannot deliver themselves from the power of the flame. There will be no coal to warm by, nor fire to sit before. Not only are you going to burn your idols, they'll burn them down to dust, and you won't even have enough to light another fire with them. There won't be a coal left behind when I'm done with them. So have those become to you with whom you've labored, who have trafficked with you from your youth. Each has wandered in his own way. There is none to save you. All right. So, perfect timing, 3 chapters, 20 minutes to go. Now comes chapter 48. The problem is, it's a little longer than the preceding two. But we have much of this repetition again. So we'll move a little bit faster here through the chapter. In chapter 48, verse 1, "Hear this, O house of Jacob, who are named Israel, and who come forth from the loins of Judah." Is he done with Babylon now? Yeah, he is. Now he's turning to address the house of Jacob, those that are named Israel, and who have arisen from the loins of Judah. Remember, there's only a remnant of the northern 10 tribes called Israel, but Judah is going to survive even after the 70 years captivity. Again, grab your pencil if you like. There is actual statements in Deuteronomy that are the opposite. Let me read the verse first and then I'll do it. "Hear this, O house of Jacob, who are named Israel, who come forth from the loins of Judah, who swear by the name of Yahweh and invoke the God of Israel, but not in truth nor in righteousness." Now, I was trying to get past my tongue here a few moments ago, is that if you'll make a marginal reference to the last half of verse 1 in chapter 48, both Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 13, and the same book, Deuteronomy chapter 10, verse 20, command the Jews to swear by the name of Yahweh and invoke the God of Israel, but Him alone. And so, as you'll see often enough, in both the Old Testament and unhappily down to this very day, you know, people who will invoke the name, but what? What did he say? Invoke the name, last statement in 48, verse 1, but not in truth and not in righteousness. And so, when the seven sons of Sceva tried to invoke the name of Jesus whom Paul preached, how'd that work out for them? Not very well. Stripped naked, running through the fields, you know, trying to escape this demon. That ain't casting anybody out. "You Jews who invoke names, but not in truth, not in righteousness," is a sobering thought for us to this day. God cares about truth, though you not know it if you're talking to people who are part of denominations today. And God cares about righteousness. And sometimes we have our own problems in that regard too, don't we? What God expects of His people is those two things, and both of those things require effort. They require conscious devotion. They require constant attention. You are not going to know the truth, even if you did know the truth, if you don't continue to study the truth, because you'll forget the truth just like you forget everything else. And you are not going to automatically remain a pure, morally upright, and righteous individual unless you're striving against the flesh and fighting against the temptations of this world and very consciously making an effort to do so. But the great majority of those in the United States, you know, call themselves Christians, think of themselves as Christians, invoke the name of the Lord, aren't practicing anything like the truth. They're nowhere near it. And then righteousness, of course, we hear these terrible scandals just all the time. So Deuteronomy 6:13 and Deuteronomy 10:20 there order them to do this, but require that it be done in truth and righteousness. Excuse me. "For they call themselves after the holy city," verse 2, "and lean on the God of Israel, Yahweh of hosts is His name." So they're doing it, but he's unhappy about it. And then verse 3 is what I believe I missed when I was doing this statements about predicting the future class a few weeks back. But you might add verse 3 if you don't have a note in that regard. "I declared the former things long ago, and they went forth from my mouth, and I proclaimed them. Suddenly I acted, and they came to pass." So even though it's just a single verse this time, and I missed it last time, still again, that theme is resonating and resounding throughout chapters 40 through 48. And it's coming up again now. I think I gave you verse 5, but look at 4 and 5. Because I know that you are obstinate, and your neck is an iron sinew, and your forehead bronze, therefore I declared them to you long ago. Before they took place, I proclaimed them to you, lest you should say, my idol has done them, and my graven image and my molten image have commanded them. So in order to prevent you thinking that these idols have done this stuff, I declared these things to you long ago. So it's really 3 through 5, or 3 and 5, where God alone can predict the future. And idols, of course, are useless. Now 6, you have heard. Look at all this. And you, will you not declare it? I proclaim to you new things from this time, even hidden things which you have not known. They are created now and not long ago. And before today, you've not heard them, lest you should say, behold, I knew them. You have not heard. You have not known. Even from long ago, your ear has not been opened. Because I knew that you would deal very treacherously, and you have been called a rebel from birth. For the sake of my name, I delay my wrath, and for my praise, I restrain it for you in order not to cut you off. Well, that's a very personal criticism. That's a very personal rebuke. You Jews, you know, who are named Israel and come forth from the loins and swear by the name of the Lord and all this, you know, you've heard, but you don't declare it. You're not telling other people, and I proclaim it in verse 6. Right now he says, new things from this time, even hidden things which you've not known. Now it's awfully tempting to say that chapter 48, starting at that verse, verse 6, it's very tempting to say that really the final chapters in that huge group, it is chapters 49 through 66, we'll be starting next week, it's tempting to say it really starts at 48:6, because 48:6 is much about new things that have not been declared before. By the time we get to the end of Isaiah, there'll be a new heavens and a new earth. And we're going to know about that new heavens and that new earth 700 years before the New Testament is going to pick up that theme and use it in Galatians and extensively in the latter portions of Revelation. So, you know, it's tempting to say, really, the last grouping in the book is 48:6 to the end. But I didn't, because nobody else does. I don't have that kind of courage. Okay, but you can see, you know, new things. Now, it could be more general, but it'll get much more specific in 49 through 66. So look for that theme then, you know, as we continue going down the next few months. We've got a long way to go, and it's going to be even tougher. Typically, we've been able to get through 2 or 3 chapters a night, and we've been successful even more than that on a number of occasions. But once you hit 49 through 66, it is so extremely interwoven with your New Testament that it's really hard to keep that same pace. And yet, it's anything but bogging down. It's just like, you know, hearing the Colorado River and in a fog as you're approaching the edge of the Grand Canyon. Well, that river would be really impressive. You hear this roaring and, you know, these magnificent rapids, and it's just, you know, this thunderous sound, but you can't see it. But suppose that simultaneously as you approach the edge of the Grand Canyon, the fog clears and you look down and you see that river, and it's a mile away reverberating up out of that canyon. You know, that's what it's been like, I think, in Isaiah. As we get to 49 through 66, the clouds clear, and there's the Christ. There's the new heavens and the new earth. There's a whole new world now. So here's an inkling of it at 48:6. But, you know, it's like the roar of the river in the fog. Wait till you see what's coming. So, you heard, look at all this. You will not declare it. I proclaim to you new things from this time, even hidden things which you've not known. They are created now and not long ago, and before today you've not heard them, lest you should say, behold, I knew them. You have not heard, you have not known, even from long ago your ear has not been opened, because I knew that you would deal very treacherously, and you've been called a rebel from birth. For the sake of my name I delay my wrath, for my praise I restrain it for you, in order not to cut you off. So I knew about these things, but again, I've been disciplining myself, God says, and revealing them at the appropriate time, and now's the appropriate time to begin with these new things. So now, 10, behold, I've refined you, but not as silver. I've tested you in the furnace of affliction. What do you refine silver in? Well, it's fire, you know, you're heat. But it's literal fire. They are refined by affliction. And so are we, and evermore shall it be. We saw that in the Colossian letter a matter of just a couple months ago. Paul said that he was filling up what? Filling up on behalf of the church. What? What was lacking in the afflictions of Christ. Remember that? Curious passage. Calls it, you know, an image of a certain amount of suffering that has to be accomplished, and then God's Son did the lion's share, but there's a share that we bear as well. It's just not easy to resist temptation. And then in 11, for my own sake, I will act. For how can my name be profaned, and my glory I will not give to another? Now, brethren, 12 through 16, we've already talked about in that class. So I'm just going to read it here. Cyrus is not named, but he's the one that's being discussed in these passages, 12 through 16. And here again, God alone can foretell the future. Verse 12, listen to me, O Jacob, even Israel, whom I called. I am he. I am the first. I am also the last. Surely my hand founded the earth, and my right hand spread out the heavens. When I call to them, they stand together. Assemble, all of you, and listen. Who among them has declared these things? Yahweh loves him. He shall carry out his good pleasure on Babylon, and his arm shall be against the Chaldeans. Now, brethren, if you're looking carefully, in my Bible, in verse 14, in the middle of that verse, it says, the Lord loves, do you have a capital H or a lowercase? Lowercase in mine as well. But then look in the last line of verse 14, and whose arm will be against the Chaldeans? Is it now capitalized or not?
Yeah.
Now it is. Now it's true, it's God's arm that's against the Chaldeans. But in my opinion, this is your last reference to Cyrus in the whole book of Isaiah. And I would have not used a capital for that last his in verse 14. I think it's his arm is a reference to Cyrus there. We've seen him so specifically before. He's the ravenous bird from the east. But, you know, it's not a big deal because both of those are true, but it appears to me it just would have fit better, you know, if we stuck with Cyrus. That's what it's about here. And then God says in 15, I, even I, have spoken. Indeed, I have called, capitalized or not. See, not. The translators know this is about Cyrus. I have brought him, not capitalized. He will make his ways successful. Well, I think that he should be capitalized. It's God that will make his, Cyrus's, way successful. Come near to me, listen to this. From the first I have not spoken in secret. From the time it took place, I was there. And now the Lord Yahweh has sent me and his Spirit. And I'm going to leave that 16th verse to you. Okay? It could be Isaiah, as he has done several times before in this book, recording his own thoughts. Come near, listen to this. From the first I haven't spoken in secret. From the time it took place, I was there. Now the Lord God sent me, Isaiah, and his spirit. Well, you know, they could be the words of Jesus, who has also been introduced. New things, and would lie behind the prophecy. Jesus, Father, and Spirit. Or, you know, I mean, it's just hard to tell what's happening right there. But what is the point right there? From the time it took place, I was there, and the Lord God has sent me and his Spirit. So take Isaiah or take Jesus, either one. Maybe got other ideas. Does it change anything? Well, yeah, it would. It would give you a different viewpoint. Does it change anything? No. The idea is still the same. God's predicting the future. 17. Thus says Yahweh your Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel. I am Yahweh your God, who teaches you to profit, who leads you in the way you should go. If only you had paid attention to my commandments, then your well-being would have been like a river, and your righteousness like the waves of the sea. Your descendants would have been like the sand, and your offspring like its grains. Their name would never be cut off or destroyed from my presence. Go forth from Babylon. Flee from the Chaldeans. Declare with the sound of joyful shouting. Proclaim this. Send it out to the end of the earth. Say, Yahweh has redeemed his servant Jacob. And they did not thirst when he led them through the deserts. He made the water flow out of the rock for them. He split the rock and the water gushed forth. There is no peace for the wicked, says Yahweh. And I think that is a final statement. And again, kind of like the chorus, you know, in a refrain, and it brings to an end what is very clearly one continuous unit, a section of prophecies in Isaiah, chapter 40 through 48. And verses 20 through 22 in chapter 48, we already considered when we had our introductory class. So here we are, worked out, you know, just perfectly tonight, got through three chapters, 46, 47, and 48. And by the way, that would be your last reference to Babylon in this book, too. See Babylon, verse 20. Go forth from it, but still there's your last occurrence of Babylon. So now, we're going to be done with Babylon. Idolatry's foolishness has been revealed. It's complete incompetence. It can do nothing but be a burden for cattle. Nail it down good when you stand him up so he doesn't fall over. You know, so it is mocked. The astrology that Babylon invented has just also been demolished as far as God goes. And then we've had our first inklings now about the Christ, who will be the primary subject that is developed at great length and in many different ways, you know, all throughout the remainder of the book, which is 18 chapters that we have to go. So, that's not right. That is right. Okay. Anybody, comment or question?